Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Wolf Among the Stars by Steve White. Narrated by Corey M. Snow. Chapter 1. Nathan Arnstein's life was not an especially long one, but it spanned a great deal of eventful history, some of which he himself made. He was born in 2011 in what still called itself the United States of America, although it had only a few years to go before the Earth First Party would seize power and rob that name of all it had once meant. He was 9 years old when the Lokaran ships appeared in Earth's sky and began dictating trade treaties. His father, a naval officer sidelined by a lack of party connections and under constant suspicion for being Jewish, was a sympathizer of the Eagleman, the secret organization of American junior military officers dedicated to the restoration of the Constitution and the expulsion of the extraterrestrials. He was 19 years old in the epochal year when the Earth First Party was overthrown, Earth narrowly saved from devastation at the hands of the Lokaran Geva of Gevragov, and the Confederated Nations of Earth formed. He was 28 and a junior officer in the United States component of the new CNE Navy when he distinguished himself in action against the Islamic jihadist diehards in the last flare-up of resistance to the new order. He was 37 and one of the rising stars of the CNEN when he was sent to the planet Harath Asor to study state-of-the-art galactic military technology at the feet of humanity's Lokaran allies of Gev Harath. He learned his lessons well and later thought of applications of them that had never occurred to the self-satisfied Lokaran military establishments. He was 55 and an admiral when he settled an old score at the Battle of Upsilon Lupus, annihilating the fleet of Gevragov and forcing a Lokaran power, for the first time in the history of the galaxy's dominant race, to sit across a peace table from non-Lokaran. And nothing would ever be the same again. He was 59 and nearing retirement when he was named to the prestigious post of director of the CNEN Academy. He was 63 when his chief of staff found him with his brains blown out.
"Is the director in, Midori?"
"Yes, Captain Rourke. Just one moment, please."
The secretary turned aside to make the adjustments necessary to admit even those who, like the chief of staff, had automatic access to Admiral Arnstein's inner sanctum. It gave Andrew Rourke a moment to glance through the transparency behind her desk. It was a view that would have been breathtaking, even if one hadn't known its history. The Academy was perched on the edge of the rim wall of a vast impact crater, with North America's Rocky Mountains circling it in the distance. The crater was, beyond comparison, the youngest of its kind on Earth, and the elements had not had time to smooth out its brutal contours. Only 4.5 decades ago, in fact, part of the Rockies had stood here. Cheyenne Mountain, in whose depths the headquarters of the United States military had been buried, safe even from nuclear bombs. But not safe from a deep-penetrator kinetic weapon, like the nickel-iron asteroid that the Lokaran of Gevragov had accelerated, using a titanic mass driver into a high-velocity trajectory that had intersected Earth at this point just before dawn on a never-to-be-forgotten autumn day in 2030, decapitating Earth's defenses and inflicting ecological wounds that had taken years to heal. It had been meant to be a mere preliminary to the saturation neutron bombing that would have left the planet a lifeless tabula rasa to be reseeded for Rogovan colonization. That had been stopped by the Lokaran of Gev Harath and by two humans who had nearly died doing it. Everyone knew all this, but Andrew Rourke knew it better than most, for those two humans, Ben Rourke and Katie Doyle, had given birth to him 4 years later. Afterward, the Confederated Nations of Earth had placed its Space Navy Academy here, using Lokaran nanotechnology to sculpt the rim wall into terraces and buildings in an architectural style, incorporating all of mankind's major traditions, looking out over the crater's floor of congealed magma. Those who studied here could never for a moment forget their service's reason for existence, which could be distilled into two words: never again.
"You can go in, Captain," said the secretary, interrupting his thoughts.
"Thanks." He proceeded through the door to her left and into a short corridor. He had long since ceased to notice the slight tingle as he stepped through the invisible curtain of stationary guardian nanobots.
The security wasn't excessive, for the director was a far more important individual than the commandants of the service academies of the last century had been. In the CNEN, his authority extended to a wide range of advanced training functions in many locales, including the hyper-prestigious Strategic College, through which the elite of the Navy's leadership must pass. Andrew came to the final door, which slid open as it sensed his genetic signature. The director's private office was a spacious one, understatedly elegant, the walls hung with honors. A shelf to the right bore models of ships he had commanded, including CNS Revenge, his appropriately named flagship at Upsilon Lupus. To the left was a hollow display tank that would have done credit to a capital ship's bridge. Behind the expansive desk, a wide transparency gave an unequaled view of the crater, including the pylon that rose at its exact center, inscribed with the names of those, worthy and otherwise, who had died in the Cheyenne Mountain strike. Andrew Rourke had seen the office a thousand times. Its familiarity explained why a detectable fraction of a second passed before that which was behind the desk registered on his brain, despite the stench of death that immediately hit his nostrils. Admiral Arnstein still had a pistol clenched in his hand, a standard M3 Gauss weapon, Andrew automatically noted. It used an electromagnetic pulse, not energetic enough to have set off the alarm system, to accelerate a high-density 3-millimeter bullet to a muzzle velocity of 2,000 meters per second with a crack as it broke the sound barrier, not loud enough to have penetrated the soundproofing of the multiple doors. It had a full automatic capability, but it appeared only one shot had been fired. Rourke now saw the hole, with a radiating pattern of cracks where it had struck the right-hand wall. Unlike the needle-like metal slivers fired by civilian Gauss weapons, such a projectile at such a velocity resulted in massive hydrostatic overpressure as it passed through a human head, causing the brain to explode outward, blowing out the top of the skull. Admiral Arnstein was slumped face down on the desk, and Rourke was looking directly into such a cavity. There was blood and fallen brain tissue everywhere around the body. Some of it had stuck to the ceiling. Modern medicine, drawing on Lokaran technology, could perform what would have been thought miracles of tissue and organ regeneration only half a century before. But nothing could be done about a destroyed brain. The Admiral could, of course, be cloned, but the clone would not be the man under whom Andrew had served at Upsilon Lupus. It would be another man with identical genetic makeup, doomed to early aging and death as a result of having been produced from post-embryonic cells taken from an adult body. Such use of cloning was interdicted by both law and custom. All this flashed through Andrew's mind in a second before the onset of nausea brought him out of shock. He sternly clamped his jaw shut and said no to his stomach. Then he raised his left arm and spoke into his wrist communicator in a voice whose steadiness surprised him. "This is Captain Rourke. Security to the director's office." Then he stumbled forward, reminding himself not to touch anything. The scene must be left scrupulously undisturbed for the investigators. He walked gingerly around the desk, looking for a suicide note. There was none, but a little plastic case of the kind used to hold data chips caught his eye. He looked more closely at it. It was marked with a tiny black symbol, and for the second time since entering the office, he froze into immobility. There could be no mistake. It was a silhouette of a dog, or, more likely, a wolf. For a few seconds, he thought very hard. He heard a commotion outside. He reached a decision. He scooped up the case, put it in his pocket barely in time, then smoothed out his features and turned to face the security detail. Chapter 2. As far back as the turn of the century, with even the youngest of the World War II veterans nearing their 80s, Arlington National Cemetery had been growing overcrowded. Later, new ground had become available after the ruling Earth First Party's ceremonial raising of the adjacent Pentagon. But that ground, too, had filled up, and by now it was a standing joke that one had to be a general or an admiral to get in. Ben Rourke's military service had consisted of a hitch in the Navy in his youth, but in his case, they made an exception. He had died at 88, not a great age in this day of Lokaran-derived biotechnology. But he had been in his 40s before he'd had access to any of that, and it had barely been enough to save his life after what his body had endured, flying a Lokaran space fighter in a forlorn hope that had actually succeeded. The morticians had wanted to fix up the areas of smooth, shiny burn tissue, the better for viewing by a funeral party, that included the President of the United States and the President General of the Confederated Nations of Earth, among others. But Katie Doyle Rourke had refused to permit it. Now she sat, not shedding the tears she had already shed in full, barely noticing the raw winter breeze that blew in off the Potomac as she stared at the coffin and listened to the skirl of the bagpipes. Out of the corner of her eye, she became aware of a blue six-digited hand, two opposable thumbs on opposite sides of four fingers, all very long and extremely dexterous, moving back and forth, gradually coming into time with the pipes. She turned and looked up at the profile of the tall, thin biped who sat beside her. His face, one always thought of a Lokaran transmitter as a he, wore an expression that was perfectly recognizable under all the alienness as one of dawning realization.
"They're playing a tune!" he exclaimed.
Katie's translator earpiece conveyed his tone of excited discovery perfectly.
"You're not the first to have that reaction to bagpipes," she admitted. "These are the good ones, though, the Irish ones, distinguished from the Scottish one by having one less drone."
Sviatog Korth looked blank. Again, far from the first, Katie thought ruefully. She had no difficulty reading his expressions after decades of practice. Most humans would have looked at his hairless head and seen simply a Lokar with large, convoluted ears, slit-pupiled yellow eyes, skull ridge running down to where it formed a bony protection for the nasal orifice, and nearly lipless mouth that, when opened, revealed serrated ridges that performed the same function as human teeth for a race of omnivores with more strongly carnivorous tendencies than Homo sapiens. They also would have taken his light blue skin for granted, for it was characteristic of Gev-Harath, the Lokaran Geva that was humanity's closest trading partner, and its offshoot Gev-Tizath, which had first discovered Earth 54 years earlier. Katie, however, knew better than most that each Geva, most often translated simply as nation, was in fact a subspecies, descended from Lokaran colonists genetically engineered to suit a world. Only Gev-Lokarath, the Geva occupying the original homeworld of the species, represented the original Lokaran genotype, narrower of features and build, and bluish-white of satiny skin. Certain other subspecies diverged from this far more than that of Gev-Harath. Gev-Rogav, for instance. Designed for a planet whose gravity was almost equal to Earth's, the Rogavan were characterized by a body build that was squat and stocky on Lokaran standards, not unlike very tall humans, in fact, and a green skin tone. It was a Lokaran genotype with which humans were familiar. Oh yes, thought Katie, very familiar, and the object of a hate that may endure as long as there is a human alive in the universe. Then the honor guard fired the salute with old-fashioned nitrocellulose-burning rifles, causing Sviatog to jump slightly, and the president and president general presented her with the folded flags of the USA and the CNE. And it was over. She got to her feet unaided, despite her 83 years, more easily, in fact, than Sviatog. The Lokar was an old Earth hand, but also inescapably a product of a 0.72G planet, besides which he, too, wasn't getting any younger. She paused for a last look at the gravesite into which her husband's remains had just been lowered, and at the waiting, vacant plot beside it. "Not just yet," she thought tartly.
"Thank you for coming, Sviatog,"
she said to her alien companion as they walked away, oblivious to the curious glances they drew.
"It would have been a great deal to him."
"Of course I came." With the automatism of long experience, Katie mentally edited out the high-pitched sounds produced by Sviatog's vocal apparatus and heard only the, dare one say it, inhumanly perfect English produced by the translation software.
"It was a stroke of good fortune that I happened to be here on Earth on Hova business." "Yes, of course. I forgot to congratulate you. And," she teased, "we humans should be flattered to rate the personal attention of the new executive director of Hof Korth."
Sviatog gave a hand gesture that, in his culture, denoted insincerely self-deprecatory denial. Executive director was a pale translation, and Katie had often thought that human history offered a far better one, Taipan. Early 21st century humans had found it hard to adjust to the fact that the Lokaran were not a monolithic politico-economic unity. That was how super-advanced space aliens had always been visualized, sometimes as an evil empire and sometimes as a goody-two-shoes democratic federation, depending on what hobby horse the individual science fiction author was riding, but always as a single polity. And that was how the Lokaran had initially represented themselves, lest the humans should get any ideas about comparison shopping. When the truth had come to light, The aliens' division into sovereign Gevahon had been hard enough to get used to. Still harder was the fact that a Geva was not the kind of centralized bureaucratic state that several generations of humans had been taught to regard as the most advanced form of social organization. It was more like the 17th century Dutch Republic, with the real power in the hands of the Hovahan, or merchant houses. Gev Rogav was an exception, but the other Lucarn had always regarded the Rogavan as rather backward. And Hav Korth was the most influential Hova of Gev Harath, the richest and most powerful Geva of the galaxy's dominant race. When Saviatog Korth, holder of no governmental office, had been introduced to the two human presidents earlier in the day, he had been just too properly deferential for words. But no one had been under any illusions as to which of the three beings counted for most in the larger scheme of things.
"Yes. I'm glad you could come," Katie repeated as they entered the parking lot.
An edge of bitterness came into her voice.
"Not everyone could."
Saviatog looked down at her from his 7-foot-plus height. He knew humans better than almost any other Lokar, and this human in particular.
"Andrew," he stated, rather than asked.
Katie nodded and did not meet his eyes.
"He said there was something going on out at the Academy that made it impossible for him to get away, even for this, and he couldn't explain what it was."
She sighed.
"I suppose I ought to understand how sometimes—"
Her voice trailed off as an air car swooped down with a faint hum of gravitics and settled onto the asphalt. It clamshelled open, and the driver emerged. A strongly built, early middle-aged man with short sandy hair, dressed in the CNE Navy's winter greatcoat of dark green edged with blackened gold, bearing a captain's insignia of 4 small starbursts. His gray eyes looked around anxiously.
"Andy!"
Katie called out in joy.
"Mom!"
They embraced, and he looked around at the stragglers of the dispersing crowd.
"It's over, isn't it? Oh, God, Mom, I'm so sorry." "Don't worry about it. We'll visit the grave together later. You remember Saviatog Korth, don't you?"
"Of course.
Thank you for coming, sir."
Andrew Rourke had known the Lokar as an occasional visitor during his youth and had always regarded him with awe as a tangible link with the heroic past, in which Saviatog had saved Andrew's parents from certain death, twice in the case of his mother. Arguably, he had done the same thing for this world of Earth.
"As I told your mother, I was fortunate to be on Earth at the right time, and it is good to see you after so many years, Captain Rourke. I have followed your career with great interest ever since your distinguished service at Upsilon Lupus."
Saviatog's alien eyes flickered from one human to the other, and then back again, and understanding flickered in their amber depths. He hitched his fur-collared cloak around his neck against the cold. The Lokaran found the attitude of modern humans toward fur-wearing disingenuous, if not hypocritical, coming from a race with such a bloodthirsty history.
"But now urgent affairs call me away, and I'm sure the two of you have much to talk about. Hopefully, Katie, not including any complaints about Captain Rourke's failure to marry and present you with grandchildren, of which I'm sure he has grown even more weary than I have."
Katie spluttered with mock indignation, and Andrew gave a laugh that was clearly pro forma. Saviatog's eyes gave the two of them another appraising glance, and then he was gone, walking with the careful steps of age and high gravity toward a large, ornate Lokaran air car. The towering alien was barely out of earshot when Andrew turned to his mother.
"I didn't tell you why I was detained at the Academy. It's all right, dear. I know you weren't allowed to talk about it. And I'm still not. But I'm going to anyway."
He drew a deep breath.
"Admiral Arnstein is dead."
"What?" Katie stared at him round-eyed for a second. Then her head slumped and she glanced back toward the gravesite she had just departed.
"Jesus. It seems like all the good ones are going."
Then she drew a deep breath and took control of herself.
"But why hasn't it been in the news? How did he die?"
"Suicide."
Andrew met his mother's incredulous stare and nodded grimly.
"That's why they're covering it up."
"Suicide?
I can't believe it. Are you sure?"
"Trust me, it's true. You see, I was the one who found him. That's why they've held me for the investigation. I was lucky to get away as soon as I did, and I'm still under orders to keep it under wraps."
"I can imagine."
Her greenish-hazel eyes sharpened as the shock of what she'd heard wore off.
"But if you're not supposed to talk about it, why are you telling me this?"
"Because I've got to talk to someone. You're the only one I know I can trust. And it doesn't hurt that you've still got debts you can call in from people in the American and CNE governments."
Her eyes sharpened still further.
"There's more to this than you've told me."
"Yes. Quite a lot."
Andrew glanced around nervously, making sure there was no one in earshot, and there was no reason for any ranged audio pickups to be focused on this place. As I said, I was the first one on the scene, and I took something from it.
You what?
I know, he said miserably, and I would never have considered doing it except... He looked around again, then reached into a pocket of his greatcoat. I found this on his desk, beside his body. He opened his hand, revealing the little data chip case marked with the odd silhouette. He let her stare at it for a second or two before clasping his hand and putting it back in his pocket. She met his eyes.
The Black Wolf Society. So they are for real.
And it would seem connected in some way with Admiral Arnstein. Connected, perhaps, in some way that caused him to find it necessary to do away with himself. She stared. Clearly, she hadn't allowed herself to think this far ahead. Rourke sympathized. He'd had more time than she for doing some very hard thinking. But she recovered quickly, which he knew shouldn't surprise him. He sometimes had to remind himself that in her youth his mother had been involved in intelligence work. One such operation had left her, by the human medical definition of the time, dead. It had been the beginning of her association with Zviatog, who had been responsible for both her death and her rebirth.
Now I understand why you didn't leave this where it was, and why you don't turn it over to the Internal Investigations Division now, she said levelly. If Arnstein was involved, then there's no telling how high it's gone, or how deep. Naturally, you've run the chip on your own computer, of course, and of course it's in code, and not one I recognize. Not that it would help much if I did recognize it. It takes a full-time expert to read this stuff. Naturally, the Navy has some very sophisticated code-breaking computers, but you can't exactly use them for this, can you?
She shook her head.
Andy, I think this is something too big for us. I know. And I have no right to involve you, but as I said before, I have no way of knowing who I can trust. The only place I could think to turn was to you and Dad. And now...
He glanced toward the endless rows of headstones, which had just gained a new fellow, and his misery deepened. Katie followed his glance, and she found she had a few unshed tears left after all.
Well, she said a little too briskly, let's at least get out of this wind. I've got a hotel room here in Arlington. You're on leave, I suppose?
Yes, indefinite leave. They let me go after all the questioning, but I'm supposed to keep the IID appraised of my movements.
And coming here was a perfectly natural thing to do. All right. Going home with me to Colorado tomorrow will also be perfectly natural. It's pretty isolated there. We'll be able to consider our options.
All right.
But before we go, of course, dear.
They turned and walked toward the freshly dug grave. Chapter 3 The following day, they took a suborbital transport from Washington to Denver, where Katie's air car was waiting. Then they headed west to Andrew Rourke's boyhood home. It was a clear winter day, and the sunlight gleamed blindingly on snow-capped peaks that rose over pine-clothed lower slopes. Some people who'd known Ben Rourke had found it surprising that he had chosen the Colorado Rockies as a retirement locale. Somewhere in the West Indies would have seemed more in character. The Caymans, where he had spent some time before the unforgettable events of 2030, or perhaps Jamaica, whose rum he had always appreciated, appreciated to excess, as some might have said. But Andrew thought he understood what had been going through his parents' minds when they'd chosen this place in the spectacularly mountainous heart of their country that had then been in the process of reclaiming the soul it had seemingly lost. Now he was surer of that than ever as the air car passed over the throat-hurtingly beautiful valley that held the Maroon Bells, Snowmass Wilderness Area, and the town of Aspen. They continued on over the sun-gleaming upland lakes and beyond, where the trees that gave the town its name, now, alas, denuded of the soft golden autumn foliage they had worn a month ago, covered the lower slopes beneath a brutally rugged crag. At the foot of that mountain, and seeming to belong there, was the rambling stone and timber house he hadn't seen in far too long. After they landed and settled in, he got a fire going in the massive stone fireplace at one end of the cathedral-ceilinged great room, flanked by windows that gave a panoramic view of the ranges to the west, while Katie mixed drinks. Then they accessed the data chip. The fire, unheated, burned low while they studied the readout.
"Can you make anything at all of this gibberish?" Katie finally asked. "I know you're not a crypto specialist, but..."
"No, I'm not, but I've had some basic familiarization. And as a souvenir of that course, I've got some elementary code-breaking software that my own computer can run.
Any luck with it?
Very little. It helps to have some idea of what you're looking for. So I've tried a few of the code-breaking software and broken a few words.
Surely you can build on that.
Not when it isn't a straight alphabet-based code. I'm sure this could be broken. There's no such thing as an unbreakable code, although various people throughout history have thought they had one. But all I've been able to do is establish that certain words do occur in this stuff. One is Admiral Arnstein's name.
No surprise, Katie put in.
Another is Black Wolf Society. I don't suppose that should be a surprise either.
I suppose not, but I'm still having trouble adjusting to the idea that it really exists.
Well, no, I guess there's never really been any doubt as to its existence. But like everybody else, I've always assumed that it's just a crime syndicate, and that the wildest stories about it are just media sensationalism. Sort of like the Sicilian Mafia in the last century. But now I have to wonder. In addition to those, I ran through anything I could think of that had any connection with Admiral Arnstein. I got occurrences of quite a few of them, but most were pretty innocuous and useless. Words like academy and earth and so forth. But a couple of my longer shots paid off. Andrew paused significantly. One was Kogurcha. Katie looked up sharply.
Well, after all, that was the system in Lupus where our confrontation with Gev Rogov began in 2057, leading to a war a decade later. So I suppose it's not too surprising.
No, it isn't. But I've saved the best for last. Andrew gave another unconsciously dramatic pause. Admiral Valdez. Katie looked up sharply.
What made you include him in your search?
Nothing, specifically. I just threw into the pot the names of all the prominent people I could think of who've been associated with Admiral Arnstein. And 4 years ago, Valdez went through the Strategic College. Older and more senior in rank than most people are when they start it, but he was a special protege of Admiral Arnstein, who had just taken charge of the Academy. He was grooming Valdez for Chief of Space Operations. He was bitterly disappointed when Valdez abruptly retired and went into CNA politics, where he's had a meteoric rise, Katie finished for him, not troubling to keep the distaste out of her voice.
So this is all you've got?
I'm afraid so. And I don't know who else I can trust to go to for advice, or for that matter, who would have anything to offer. Silence fell and stayed fallen for a while. Then Katie visibly reached a decision. She looked her son in the eye.
There might be one person. You see, your father knew Valdez. He met him, oh, it must have been more than 10 years ago, because it was before the war. And he was always very reticent about what they said to each other.
Really? I never knew that. But, Andrew trailed to an awkward halt. But what good does that do us now? I mean, that is, well, that is...
Katie smiled. Don't worry, I haven't lost my marbles yet. There's something else you don't know. A few years ago, when we were having to face the fact that your father didn't have very much longer to live, Sviatog came here on one of his visits and presented us with a gift. At first, we were reluctant to accept it, and only partly because it was extravagantly expensive, not that that's any object to Sviatog, but we finally did, while your father was still mentally alert.
She held his eyes.
It was a full set of state-of-the-art uploading equipment, with all the accessories, including the ability to project an all-senses virtual image, not just a voice.
It took several heartbeats before what Andrew had heard registered on him. Several more passed before he could speak.
Are you saying that Dad is...
Katie nodded gravely.
Yes, he is. So am I, incidentally, just for future reference.
Her lips quirked upward in a smile of almost invisible brevity. Then she sighed, and her eyes strayed to the mountains outside the windows.
I haven't accessed it yet. I think it will be a while before I do. Before I can. But you may want to do it now, if you feel up to it.
Andrew sank back in his chair and tried to sort out his feelings. What was antiseptically called uploading, copying a brain's memories through a painless but lengthy combination of external scanners and probing nanomachines, and storing them digitally, was fairly new technology even to the Lokaran. At first, its inventors had thought they were on the brink of being able to transfer those memories to the brain of a clone of the brain's owner, thus achieving a kind of serial immortality. That dream, nightmare, as some might have said, had proven illusory. The process took finite time, during which an organic brain, unlike a passive piece of neural net software, could not accept such an imprinting. That digital program could, however, be installed in a computer, a very special, very powerful, very complex, and very expensive computer.
The multi-terabyte software then became self-aware, able to run whatever other programs were available to the computer, including those allowing it to communicate interactively.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?